Hello and welcome to the First 10 Pages. I'm your host, Keith, and this is going to be a very special episode because I have a guest. Yes, and I'll get to that in a minute, but let's talk about the movie that we're covering today. Beverly Hills Cop, which changed the face of film as you know it. Not only was it Eddie Murphy's first solo starring role, after he co-starred with Dan Aykroyd in Trading Places and prior to that with Nick Nolte in 48 Hours, but it might very well be the first big deal summer tentpole action movie starring a black guy, specifically Eddie Murphy. Before that, we had movies that had co-stars, we had blaxploitation films like Shaft, but this was a big mainstream Hollywood studio film, and that is a big deal. Not only that, but the star of it was always the smartest person in the room everywhere he went. And it changed the face of cop films. Because before this movie, every cop movie was kind of like dark, serious, Dirty Harry, thriller, serial killer on the loop, that kind of thing. Okay, like Burt Reynolds tried it with a couple of his movies, but they certainly didn't have the effect that Eddie Murphy did with Beverly Hills Cop, because everything after that was Lethal Weapon, or Die Hard. Come out to the coast, I'll have a good time. You know, we didn't have those kinds of jokes before that. Now every cop movie had to have jokes. Beverly Hills Cop was made for $13 million and made $320 million around the world. It starred Eddie Murphy in his first big deal role, as said, Judge Reinhold in his first role anybody cared about, John Ashton, Ronnie Cox, Gil Hill as Inspector Todd, Jonathan Banks, who up until this movie was one of those, hey, it's that guy. You know, you'd see him on TV shows and movies and be like, oh yeah, that guy. And then of course he had a big hit many years later with Breaking Bad and then Better Call Saul. And of course, this movie introduced us to Bronson Pinchot, who was Serge, and went on to become Balki Bartokmos. And I nearly forgot the most underappreciated player in this whole team. This person who needs more attention and who was sorely missed from the sequels, Lisa Eilbacher. And we will talk a little bit about her later on. But now, let me introduce my guest to you. My guest, who is a friend of mine and a lover of 80s action films. He is best known for sitting on his sofa and watching movies
and for ignoring his girlfriend's movie night suggestions.
These are not the names of projects or TV shows he's been in. These are things that he does, and I keep telling him not to do the latter. It's not good. Anyway, please welcome my friend Kurt. Hey, Kurt.
Hi, Keith. How are you?
I'm good. I gave a little intro about you. I forgot to say that the thing you're probably most well known for is being the only person on Earth who actually saw the Sylvester Stallone film Cobra in theaters.
Yes, which I should not have because I was underage.
Well, that's okay. It was the 80s. We were allowed to do anything in the 80s. Left alone in a theater? Nothing.
Yes.
I'm going to now give you a pop quiz. There are no wrong answers. This is just a good way for the audience to get to know you.
Okay.
All right. First, favorite 80s action movie?
Die Hard.
Favorite 80s comedy film?
Airplane.
Nice. Favorite film that shoots a beam into the sky?
Oh, there's been a lot of those. I will say The Avengers.
Favorite film where an actor proves they've got no range by playing against type?
Keanu in his early work, Much Ado About Nothing, was, I would say, yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to go with Evil Kermit in Muppets Most Wanted. I mean, come on, it's Kermit.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean,
yes. Because he's evil. How could he be evil? Yes.
Yeah, I didn't buy it for a second.
Favorite movie with Christopher Lloyd that's not Back to the Future?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
We would have also accepted Going South. Favorite movie that uses too much yellow?
Godfather. Uses too much yellow. Okay, one and two.
That is true.
Yeah. Those are, yeah, especially two.
Yes.
Two has a lot of yellow. Flashbacks.
Yes.
Gold
yes.
And yellow.
Yes.
Mine is Amelie, not a favorite of mine, just a movie with too much yellow.
Yes.
Okay. And finally, ruin a movie by adding a word. I will give you examples. Breakfast at Tiffany's, Sorority. When Harry Met Sally, Struthers. Ian Fleming's On Her Majesty's Secret VCR Service.
The Breakfast Club sandwich.
Wow, there we go. I like it. Nice work. Well done.
Thank you.
And that ends the quiz portion of our program.
Ew.
You've gotten a 90%.
Yes.
So as you know, we are talking about Beverly Hills Cop. I've already given people the basics. Before we get into the script read, we could talk a little bit about the director, Martin Brest. He had only made two student films and one mainstream studio film before Beverly Hills Cop. That studio film was Going in Style. Mm-hmm. And it starred George Burns, Art Carney, and Lee Strasberg.
Mm.
Who people don't really know as a movie star, but they know him from the Strasberg Method, or the method acting.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting that I don't know if this was his sort of biggest last movie, but it's probably one of his biggest final films.
I know Strasberg from, he was in Back to Godfather. He's in Godfather 2. I didn't know he did anything after that. So
yeah, the movie happened, was actually remade by Zach Braff with Morgan Freeman, Michael Caine, and Alan Arkin.
Yeah.
Both were cute movies. I remember seeing the original on TV as a kid. That was Martin Brest's only big project. He was supposed to direct War Games, but
yes,
he wanted to take it seriously. And the studio didn't want that. Which is interesting that he was then brought on to Beverly Hills Cop, which has this whole history of, is it a serious action movie or a comedy action movie?
Right.
I'm going to jump to the script read. Do you want to tell people what time to jump to if they want to skip the script read?
What time they could jump to?
Yeah, yeah. Just take a guess. If it's wrong, I'm going to replace it. It's not a big deal.
At the 15 minute
time. No.
The quarter hour.
Okay.
I haven't done this before. Why are you asking me?
Just because it was fun. Go to 20 minutes, 15 seconds.
Hey, Beverly Hills Cop, a Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer production by Daniel Petrie Jr. and Sylvester Stallone. Oh, a final draft, March 30th, 1984.
Really? That can't be right. Fade in. Exterior, the city of Detroit. Day. A strong wind blasts across Lake St. Clair and roars through the downtown streets. Exterior, Detroit streets, various angles, day. We see quick images of Detroit, and these will be the quick images with details. A black kid who's been up all night shivers as he hops along, ghetto blaster on his shoulder. A newspaper truck is dumping off a stack of papers in front of a small tarnished newsstand. A trio of mangy dogs stroll across an intersection. Several hookers in miniskirts wait outside a closing bar. Zombie-like trash men hurl bags of garbage into a slowly cruising garbage truck. Exterior Detroit Street, day. Decrepit abandoned warehouses and storefronts line the block. There's no sign of life here. The early light shows rubbish piled against the curb, black with grease and dirt. Halfway down the block, apparently deserted, is a huge, dirty, silver and blue Peterbilt 16-wheel semi. The door of the rear trailer is partially open. Interior, rear trailer. The trailer is packed almost floor to ceiling with cases of cigarettes. There's a narrow aisle of sorts between the stacks of cigarettes. Two small-time hoods, Rizza and Mirsky, stand in the center of the aisle, whispering to each other. Rizza moves forward to his friend. Yeah, it's all here. Come on. Mirsky, anxious. Let's get moving. Hey, I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
A case of cigarettes, dropped from overhead, narrowly misses Rizza and Mirsky, landing at their feet. Axel Cobretti, a very good-looking, outgoing, totally unselfconscious man of 30, hops down into frame from the top of the stack of cigarette cases. Axel is dressed very casually in a pair of jeans and a jacket that's seen a lot of use. Axel.
You guys make up your mind?
Axel rips open the case he's tossed down from above, picks a carton at random, tears it open, and hands Rizza and Mirsky a pack of cigarettes each. Mirsky nervously eyes the empty street.
You got your state of Michigan tax stamps on the back of every one.
Rizza. So why don't you keep them? Go into business for yourself. It's such a fucking good deal.
Let's just say I don't smoke.
Let's get out of here. What the hell are we waiting for?
Rizza turns the pack of stolen cigarettes over and over in his hands.
Listen, you do what you want. You don't like the deal, walk away.
Rizza raises his eyebrows. Mirsky nods and continues to eye the street.
Okay.
To Mirsky. Start it up. And Mirsky ducks out under the rear trailer door.
Hey, you got something for me?
Rizza hands Axel an envelope. Axel opens it and starts to count a wad of bills. Exterior, the truck, day. Mirsky looks up and down the empty street before hopping into the cab and cranking the engine. Interior, the rear trailer. Axel stuffs the cash back into the envelope.
Close enough. It's all yours, pal.
Exterior, the truck. Angle on the rear trailer, day. Rizza has jumped down from the rear trailer. Axel is at the edge of the trailer, hand on the cord that lowers the rear doors. They stand frozen. Their POV.
A Detroit police car is pointed right at them. Axel's lips form the word shit, but he doesn't speak out loud. Angle on the police car.
Two youngish cops, ties untied, bomber jackets half open, hair rather too long to go with the uniform cap, get out of their car. First cop.
Hey, what the hell you doing here?
In the cab, Mirsky has the engine running. He stares out the side view mirror at the cops walking toward the truck.
He licks his lips and puts the truck into gear, ready to take off.
He slips a pistol out of his jacket. Axel tries to play it cool.
Are we glad to see you? You want to call us a tow? We threw a bearing.
The second cop has been staring at Axel.
I know you from someplace.
Rizza panics and runs toward a pickup truck parked across the street. He doesn't have a chance. The cops draw their guns.
Hey, freeze!
Angle on the truck's cab. Mirsky lets out the clutch and the rig jerks forward. Axel is still standing on the bed of the rear trailer of the moving truck. The second cop yells at him.
Get down off of there!
But Axel stays where he is,
hanging on as the truck gains speed. Axel braces himself at the side of the trailer to offer a narrow street, but now the truck is going about 40 as it takes the next corner. I don't really know what that means, side of the trailer to offer a narrow street. I'm assuming it's a typo, but I can't quite figure out what the word would be. So on we press.
And the rear trailer, over the curb, and fishtails into a parked car. It looks like the truck is going to jackknife, but instead it comes out of the turn, gathering more speed. Axel is nearly thrown off the rear of the truck, but he hangs on. The Detroit police car follows, siren screaming. Its flashing red and amber lights provide the only color in the otherwise monochromatic inner city.
Ooh, artsy.
The truck hurtles almost out of control down the street and around corners as, I think it's supposed to be hurls almost out of control down streets and around corners as Mirsky at the wheel takes increasingly demented chances, trying desperately to get away from the police cars and two more cop cars joining the chase as we watch.
Every time I say something, the police cars, Mirsky, that means it's in caps on a line by itself, because these are various shots that we're seeing in quick succession, and that's how they did it. The giant truck
pounds through Center City at 87 miles an hour. The fantastic vibration nearly shakes the suspension apart. A taxi frantically veers to avoid the stampeding monster truck, the rear trailer. The stacks of cigarette cases go flying everywhere, and Axel is forced to play dodgeball with cases of cigarettes that bounce past him and out into the roadway. The first of the pursuing police cars catches a case of cigarettes right on the front bumper, and the case shreds into its component parts. The car goes into a 360-degree skid over the slick cigarette packs, and the second police car smashes head-on into the first. The other cop cars skid to a panic stop just shy of the obstruction. A newsstand explodes from the impact of the truck as it roars around the corner. Mirsky, in the cab of the speeding 18-wheel Peterbilt, is watching the cop cars recede in his rearview mirror. The truck heads down a narrow street at terrifying speed, and the waterfront. Mirsky realizes the truck is out of control and impossible to turn safely. Mirsky frantically shifts gears. The barreling truck lunges like an attacking lion over the pavement and into the water. Axel is thrown forward, deep into the rear trailer among the falling stacks of cigarette cases, as the truck violently rips into the black water. The truck's engine steams above the blackness of the river and begins to sink at an alarming speed. Angle on the truck's cab. Mirsky, dazed, tries to open the door. The water pressure has him sealed in. Water pours in under the dashboard. Mirsky panics. Angle on the rear of the trailer. Cases of cigarettes avalanche on Axel as thousands of gallons of water pour with terrifying force into the trailer's open rear door. The massive machine begins to buckle in half, forcing the rear end and escape route to an up angle. Mirsky, in waist-high water, kicks insanely at the side window, which shatters and tears out under the repeated kicks. Mirsky crawls out. Axel grips the wood slats that line the walls of the interior of the trailer, and with all his strength pulls himself forward against the lethal onrushing water. The rear of the trailer is nearly underwater as Axel clears the submerging death trap. He spots Mirsky swimming to a mountainous garbage barge with trash that appears to reach to the top of the skyscrapers that faintly loom in the BG background. Mirsky is thrashing wildly through the blackness, desperately looking back at Axel's progress. Axel swims after the thief in strong athletic strokes, which closes the gap quickly. Mirsky reaches out and hauls his frenzied form onto the massive barge. He looks at Axel, cutting through the water, and begins to retreat up the towering hill of waste. A pair of straining hands
grips the side of the barge, and Axel swings aboard and pursues Mirsky. Mirsky looks down over his shoulder and spies his gaining pursuer. The top of the barge, Mirsky breathlessly arrives and wildly scans the debris for a weapon. He throws several empty bottles at Axel. Bottles thud and scatter around Axel. He is only yards away. Mirsky picks up another pair of bottles and cracks them together, instantly creating a matching set of jagged, razor-sharp weapons. Come on! Come on! Axel reaches the top and swiftly sidesteps as a jagged bottle rakes near his face. He sidesteps another lunge by Mirsky and pile drives the thief with a chopping blow. Mirsky stands at the top of the barge with Axel. As he cuts loose with a swift right to Mirsky's midsection, the criminal tumbles over backward and cascades down the hill. Axel is bent over trying to catch his breath when a voice through a microphone booms out.
Don't move.
Harbor Patrol boat. The outline of several harbor patrolmen holding what appears to be rifles.
What are you doing there?
Axel stands erect and, taking a deep breath, slowly exhales and eyes the trash all around him. Axel gives a look of almost disarming innocence.
Getting some fresh air.
Idiot. Interior Detroit Police Station, day. The station is energized with constant movement as police of all sizes, genders, and colors move in a multitude of directions. Several black youths, are being brought in handcuffs. They defiantly slow down. Cop.
Walker be dragged. Move it, hard case.
The two youths increase their speed as the main entry door opens. Axel, looking very dirty, worn, and intense, is bumped against by the two youths as they pass. The arresting cop smirks at Axel's disheveled appearance. Cop, continuing, keeps moving.
You been staking out a garbage can, Cobra?
Close.
Todd's looking for you. Axel nervously eyes Todd's empty office at the other end of the main pool of the cop desks in the center of the decaying room. The cops are typing two-finger style as they ask questions of suspects or fill out complaints from local residents. Axel starts to move down the dark, dismal hallway. A youngish, bushy, dark-haired, almost bookish cop, holding a file under his arms, speeds up behind Axel. Stu.
Todd's gonna kick your ass.
Nice to see you again, Stu.
This is so brilliant. He's smoking. Did you really dump a truck in the river?
Yeah.
Why?
Couldn't find a parking space. Where's Todd now?
Probably looking for you. Why don't you wait in his office?
Hey, Stu, what are you, the social director around here today?
Don't take kindness for weakness, Cobra. I'm trying to help you out here.
Hey, I've been thinking about buying a new piece.
A .44 mag. Where can I get a good buy?
Hey, Stu, what do you need a magnum for? To shoot an angry file cabinet?
Axel pushes open a door that is marked locker room.
Forget it. I told you Todd wants to see you. So where are you going?
To get hygienic.
Door closes.
What? No one said anything about hygiene. No one says that. So why is that a line?
Honey. Interior police locker room. Day.
The constant hiss of the shower fills the room. Locker doors slam as entering and exiting cops pass down the narrow way. The cops that are present in no way resemble Axel in body or attitude. They are mostly from the old school. In the distance, a booming voice is heard.
We're not going to take much more of your bullshit. You want to play some bullshit, cowboy cop? Do it in somebody else's precinct.
Inspector Todd is black and 55. His hair is just starting to turn gray. He stares at Axel, furious. Axel is in the shower. Two out-of-shape cops are behind him.
Okay, I mean, hey, to each his own.
9 hours! They say it's going to take the River Patrol 9 hours to haul that truck out of the river. You have any idea what that is going to cost the city?
More than I can afford?
Axel steps out of the shower and moves to his locker.
Much more! I got a call from the deputy mayor. I got a call from the chief. I got a call from a group vice president of the Harbor Commission and 3 calls from goddamn environmentalists. So naturally, I said, get me Detective Cobretti. Now what the hell were you doing with that goddamn truckload of cigarettes, Cobra?
The truck was from the hijacking in New Jersey last week.
That bus went down last week. That truck was supposed to be impounded as evidence.
Yes, sir, but they didn't exactly have room for it down at the pound. It's a very long piece of equipment, but I don't have to tell you that.
No, you don't.
So I figured since it was going to be parked on the street,
you might as well run one of your scams. How come you were running this scam on your own without any backup?
Several cops nearby are dressing, and I Axel with obvious jealousy.
Okay, let's just move on.
I thought it'd work better alone.
Hey, if you would use a little teamwork for once, that kind of thing wouldn't happen.
You could have had a car parked out of sight to monitor the radio calls. They could have intercepted the patrol car and backed you for the bust. We're tired of taking the heat for you.
Axel smiles.
It is getting kind of warm in here.
Yeah, see, there's some subtext here.
Okay, Cobra, I'm through, but no more of these setups. I'm telling you for the last time, stop forcing things. You'll make your bus. Let things happen on the natural.
On the natural. Todd turns and starts away.
Inspector, you know, most men are never appreciated in their own lifetime.
Todd laughs.
Go to hell, Cobra.
And that is page 13. So we went a little long, but I wanted to get some of that dialogue in. So there you have it.
Okay, and that was our script read. As you heard, it was much more serious than the version that ended up in theaters.
Right.
This version was written for Stallone by Stallone. I did find a couple of references that said Stallone did it by himself. I found a couple more that said it was done with Daniel Petrie Jr., which would explain why his name is still on the script and why it's above Stallone's.
Right.
There was an article written by someone named Brian Cronin for the now-defunct site Spinoff Online, in which he discussed in detail that the original script, written by Daniil Bach, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, was a straight actioner. The script kicked around Hollywood for like 6 years or something until producer Don Simpson got a hold of it. And then he brought in, for reasons unknown, screenwriter Daniel Petrie Jr. I say that because dude had no credits prior to Beverly Hills Cop. According to his Wikipedia page, he didn't even really seem to have a career. But his dad was an agent.
Yeah.
To his credit, Paramount did love his take. He was the one that turned it into an action comedy, which allowed it to be a little bit lower budget. He's also the guy that fixed the name of the main character, who was originally Kelly Axel, and he made it Axel Kelly, and I guess eventually Axel Foley. It was Stallone who made it Axel Cobretti, so that way he could have the cool nickname of Cobra. Yeah, he wanted a cool nickname, but that didn't quite work out. The script was eventually sent to Stallone. Stallone, at that point, was very aware that comedy was not for him. Stallone had rewritten it back into an action movie because in some interview he said,
"When I saw it, I thought they sent it to the wrong guy."
Okay, that was probably their point in sending it to him, but all right, Kurt.
So, what did you think of Sylvester Stallone's
Beverly Hills Cop?
The dialogue, the action is as much, it is like I'm reading a Stallone action film.
Right.
I guess one of the funniest things in, like on page two, it's describing Alex Cobretti, a very good looking, outgoing, totally unselfconscious man of 30.
Yes.
You know what that means.
It looks like it's something that was written to make Stallone feel good.
Clearly. just the type of action that's involved. It's really like a different movie. It's similar, clearly, in terms of like just the way it's structured for what was actually filmed.
Right.
But just like look at Eddie Murphy versus Stallone, it's two different movies.
And that's what's so fascinating about it, is that it is the same scene. It's the same.
Yes.
What's on screen is more or less the montage that the writer wanted, more or less. It's the same characters, and you know, everyone's got their same part to play. And there's the guy who's buying the cigarettes. There's the partner who's not so sure about this guy. They're in the truck. There's the truck chase. It's all the same stuff.
Yeah.
It just feels very rote here. It also seems to be unfairly setting up what we're about to see. I don't know if you looked at the rest of the script at all, but the movie gets very dark. Whereas Beverly Hills Cop, the final film, introduces Mikey, who gets killed, which is why Eddie Murphy's character goes to Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
This introduces Michael as Cobra's brother. And he doesn't just get killed. He gets his hands chopped off later on in the script.
Right.
There's also an exchange later on about Jenny. Axel is saying, "Oh, I haven't seen Jenny for maybe 10 years. And Michael goes, that's his brother, says, "Oh, she looks good. Good or very good? Very good. She didn't beef up or nothing." And then Axel says, "Trim and healthy." And his brother goes, "Christ, are you a doctor now?" "Yeah, trim and healthy. Hey, listen, I got to get moving." What is that? What even? I mean, put the misogyny aside for a second.
Yeah.
It's such a strange exchange. It makes me think of that moment in the first 10 pages where I joked during the script read when the two cops are staring at Cobra in the locker room.
Mm-hmm.
And then he smiles and says, "It's getting hot in here." Is there supposed to be an undercurrent of homosexuality here? Or was that put in there like and Stallone was completely unaware of it. Was that in Cobra? My question for you is, was that subtext of homosexuality in Cobra?
Sure, yes. It's been a few.
I know there's a lot of leather in it.
Yes, there's a lot of leather. His ex-wife, I believe, was in it. Brigitte Nielsen.
Jenny is introduced in Act One of the movie, but not in the first 10 pages. I said in my intro that the actress, Lisa Eilbacher, she's this unsung hero of Beverly Hills Cop. She plays that character just so perfectly. I remember thinking this as a kid, that I loved that we had a movie with a male lead and a very beautiful female lead, and there's never a moment where you think there's going to be a romance between them. And I think that's a great, great thing.
Yeah. No, they're just friends, so.
Right.
Let's talk about the montage that's in the script, because the movie opens with images that are similar, but
also completely different from the script. The focus is supposed to be, in the movie, it's inner Detroit and, black kids and teens and sort of black culture, obviously setting up the contrast for when Axel lands in Beverly Hills. The script seems to be like, hey, here's a city.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know what zombie-like trash men are supposed to be.
Right. But we had to be sure that the black guy had a boombox.
Right, yeah, exactly.
In the 80s, all black guys had boomboxes.
Yes.
The great thing about the end of that montage on screen is that Martin Brest and his editor did a very clever thing. The first shot of Axel and the trucks is a bird's eye point of view in that alleyway. And you actually think it's part of the montage at first.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Until it holds just a little bit longer.
Right.
And you're like, oh, we're in the movie now.
Right.
And I thought that was very clever. And I'm sure that there were a ton of movies at the time that were doing that. The pacing and style of this movie was very much 70s, early 80s editing and style. I mean, taking out the comedy of it, as was done by Stallone, if you look at that opening sequence, that could have been a Dirty Harry movie. That could have been a bad Steven Seagal movie. And I say that clarifying that there are no good Steven Seagal movies.
Yeah, I was going to say, what good Steven Seagal? No, and also just kind of showing, like, this is Detroit, 1984, and there had been a lot of decay, and, we saw the abandoned houses and the factories shutting down, so I think it did. And looking at the notes from IMDb, it sounded like he had the police actually escort him through certain areas so he could film, because they were kind of freaked out.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're like, you want to go there? Oh, okay. So he went to some gritty parts of town. And then we see, the old warehouses and then, the bird's eye view.
The thing that we miss watching it at home, and I always say that the thing that people forget about going to the theater is the impact.
Yeah.
When you're trapped in a room with a screen that's 50 feet high.
Yeah.
The idea of the contrast between Detroit and Beverly Hills is much stronger because those images stuck in your head a little bit longer because they were on a giant screen that was 50 feet high, whereas at home, it doesn't stick in your head over the next, he doesn't get to Beverly Hills for another 25 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the gray grittiness of Detroit in your home doesn't stand out when Beverly Hills is shown all green and orange and yellow and pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a really important contrast that happens on screen that we didn't read it in the script, but clearly that's what's being set up in the script, is that contrast. Even the Stallone version is clearly being. The thing about the script also, what I was saying before, is that it gets very dark. Like I said, his brother Michael doesn't just get killed. He gets his hands chopped off and has a lot of misogyny, apparently. But Eddie makes it clear by his second line that he's putting on a voice.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know Eddie Murphy from anything else prior to this, he's putting on a voice, so you're already laughing.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you don't know that he's putting on a voice, because you've never seen Eddie Murphy before, his third or fourth line was, these cigarettes are popular with the kids.
Yes.
obviously an ad lib.
Right.
And great. And then within a few minutes of that, he's doing the whole read my lips, $5,000. that whole thing. And it sets up everything. Now, the other thing that people forget is going into this movie, if you hadn't seen the trailer, you don't know that he's a cop. We, the audience, don't know that he's the cop in this.
Right.
Yet. You know, there's no tip-off until the police show up, and in the script, Stallone's character mouths, shh.
Right.
But Eddie Murphy's character just kind of did one of these. He did an eye roll, like, oh, man, here we go. But again, that eye roll could be, I'm getting caught.
Right.
It's not until the end of that Neutron Dance chase scene where the cop goes, oh, Axel, you know.
Right.
That they reveal it. I feel like with Stallone, and that's because it's Eddie Murphy. And with Stallone, you wouldn't question it. You're like, okay, this is an undercover cop. And I feel like the bad guys would have gone like, oh, yeah, this is an undercover cop.
Right. And also just, it's also just the way Eddie's dressed, the way he's carrying himself.
Right.
Yeah. You'd never guess he was a cop.
No, you absolutely would not. There's actually a scene later on where he has that confrontation with Inspector Todd, the second confrontation with Inspector Todd about how he wants to be on the case.
Right.
The scene that we get early on with Todd really does set that moment up because Todd says to him, you got to stop playing games, but you're a good detective and I trust you. Axel then tries to parlay that into being put on this case, but there's too much distrust.
Right.
And he's too young, which was also established early on.
Right.
See, I'm looking at my notes. Oh, something that stood out to me in the script was the description of the precinct. In the script read, I went to page 13 or 14 just to get a little bit more Inspector Todd in there and a little bit of that. So if you actually did cleanly stop at page 10, I'm not sure if you saw it. But the precinct is described to have people of all colors and genders and et cetera. Because we're supposed to, I guess we're going to contrast that also with Beverly Hills, which I'm sure was later on described as being a whole bunch of white skinny cops,
right?
Or something, right. You know. But in the movie, what we got was a bunch of white cops who all looked like they came out of In the Heat of the Night in Detroit.
Yes.
You know, it was an interesting choice. I felt like maybe Martin Brest was trying to show that Eddie Murphy's character didn't fit in there either.
Yeah.
On screen, a couple of things that I noted was that we didn't get the Axel F theme until 11 minutes in, which is interesting to me. The fact that in the first 15 minutes, we have two songs that made the top 10 of the Billboard charts is interesting to me.
Yeah, they were both very big. Yeah, I didn't realize they were, and they were like back to back pretty much as well.
Yeah, the thing that people don't realize is that in the 1980s, after this movie, you could turn on your top 40 radio station and you would hear, you know, your normal top 40 songs and also the Axel F theme.
Yes.
Which, I mean, can you imagine turning on a top 40 station now and you hear Billie Eilish and then like the theme from the Avengers? That'll never happen again.
Right. It was this and then the Chicka Chicka from Ferris Bueller. Right. Those were the two. You could turn on the radio and they'd be on. You'd be like, what the heck's going on here?
Right. So, right. And that song had, the only words of that song were,
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. Those were songs that got radio play.
If I'm remembering correctly, didn't it get like a video as well on MTV? And they just put scenes to Beverly Hills Cop to Axel F?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think every now and again it cuts to Faltermeyer at his keyboard.
Right. Yep.
And I'm sure, because it was, what's it called? It's not a, it's a keyboard, but it's a
synthesizer.
Thank you. Synthesized soundtrack. That was probably a big deal. And I'm sure the studio balked at that at first, I would imagine.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, there had to be a fight about that. I haven't looked it up. The only other movies that I could think of that were getting synthesized music were like Halloween and other Carpenter films, because he was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then like a couple of those, like, I don't know if it was Ice Pirates or something else, but one of those other kinds of really bad Star Wars ripoffs had synthesizer music. These were considered cheap Z-movie soundtracks, scores. This was not what you would put on a big summer tentpole film at the time.
Nope.
So, all right. We've talked about the differences. We've talked about what Stallone brought to it and what he pleaded from it. The first 10 pages, Kurt, on the page, do we get a movie that a studio executive would want to make in those first 10 pages?
I would say no.
I would say the answer is clearly no, because they did not.
That is correct.
And part of the reason why is not just because it's so rote, it's so typical of the genre, even by the mid-80s. It also doesn't properly set up what comes later. We're not getting who Cobra is in those first 10 pages. He's not a smartass, although he tries to be. He's not a con man. I don't think that comes back later. I skimmed the script. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it.
No.
There's nothing here that's giving us the movie that it becomes. Again, it becomes more of a Dirty Harry, a darker Dirty Harry film. On screen, what do you think of those first 10 pages, 10 minutes?
Right.
How does that encapsulate what we're about to see for the rest of the movie?
Oh, yeah. I would say yes, definitely.
We know exactly who Axel is in the first 10 seconds of him talking.
Mm-hmm.
Except that we don't know for sure that he's a cop. And then that reveal happens, you know, 4 minutes later.
But as we see later on in the movie, because of when he inserts himself in situations, he doesn't come off as a cop, which is why it works. Which is why he can get in.
Right. Oh, that's a great point.
Sweet talk his way.
Sweet talk his way. And like you said, it's how he's dressed and how he carries himself. And by not acting like a cop, he's able to, you know, get close to the guy with the shotgun in the strip club.
Right.
He's able to be the delivery man who takes the flowers right up to the bad guy.
Right.
One thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of the whole movie and the sort of bigger picture was the evolution of the relationships.
Yes.
That stuff is so tight that it's in terms of the script and the writing and the acting. I mean, all those guys really worked well together, including the
no banana in the tailpipe guy.
Even those guys who just have a few minutes of screen time, their story evolves. There's an arc there.
Mm-hmm.
Axel and Taggart obviously immediately get off on the wrong foot. Taggart punches him.
Mm-hmm.
But Eddie Murphy kind of respects that he punched him.
Mm-hmm.
So Eddie Murphy's Axel likes Taggart.
Right.
And Taggart doesn't trust or like Eddie Murphy until the strip club scene where Eddie Murphy's instincts prove to Taggart that he's a good cop and he knows what he's doing.
Right.
And then they lose them with the banana and the tailpipe and the B team comes in, right? And the B team then confronts, well, first they confront Taggart and Billy and they make fun of them losing the gig, right?
Right.
And then they go out and they lose Axel. And then Axel ends up in front of Bogomil.
Right.
And Bogomil doesn't like him either, hasn't really interacted with him except for a few seconds. I think he smiles at something he says or something he does at one point earlier.
Mm-hmm.
In this scene where it's Bogomil, Billy, Taggart,
but down in the tailpipe guy,
and his partner, they're all there together in the squad room. And then Bogomil dresses him down, lets Axel talk and go, okay, well, why do you think Maitland is a bad guy?
Right.
And he explains the coffee grounds thing.
Right.
And it's Bogomil who goes, oh, well, that's how they hide drugs. Okay, maybe you do have something here. Taggart didn't know that. Rosewood didn't know that. The other two guys didn't know that. But now those four guys all see Bogomil giving credence to something that Axel just said.
Right.
And so right away at that moment, they're a team. And from that point on, they all act as a team.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a beat sheet of this, which is, you know, that's where the studio or the writers or production, they make a beat sheet that says the A plot, B plot, C plot, etc., where they all begin and end.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of Axel and Taggart and Banana and the Tailpipe guy and Taggart and Billy and Banana and the Tailpipe guy and Axel all come to an end in that scene.
Right.
You don't see that kind of writing in action movies today. You don't see that ability to do such a strong arc.
No, sadly, we do not.
Why is Jenny smoking in the art gallery?
Because she could in 1984. She's nervous.
Okay. But she's around works of art that cost thousands and thousands of dollars.
I thought that too. Yes. You would have thought she would have taken a step outside.
Yeah.
There's no air filter around her or anything.
No,
no.
If you purchased a work of art from the Maitland Gallery in the 1980s, you may have a claim. Contact us through the Class Action Suit channel.
Come in for a free steaming. Yeah.
The interesting thing also about this is how slow the pacing is in the beginning of the movie. Because it is very much the pacing of a 70s cop movie.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then, of course, Tony Scott came in.
Yes.
And did Beverly Hills Cop 2. And he gave it what they called at the time MTV-style editing. Critics hated it because, oh, there's too many cuts. It's too fast. It can't follow it. Right? Like, I don't know if you remember that from when we were teenagers.
Yes. I remember, it was too fast.
I mean, I remember thinking that, oh, this is what movies are going to look like now. Do you know that there was supposed to be a much quicker Beverly Hills Cop 3 put into production than the one that we got, which was terrible and sad?
Would it have been less terrible, less sad?
I'll say this. when I read the title, we were what, in our 20s maybe when this was originally announced? When I read this title, I was like, oh my God, that is hysterical. I thought the title alone was really funny.
Yeah.
Because it was called Beverly Hills Cop in London. I mean, yeah, make that movie.
So why didn't they?
The thing I recall reading in the trades at the time was that either the studio or Murphy didn't feel the script was quite there. What we ended up with was Eddie Murphy, who, by the way, said that Axel wasn't allowed to be funny in Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Was that his direction?
Mm-hmm. According to, who directed that? Was that Landis that directed that?
That was Landis, yeah. That was Landis, right? Who directs comedies.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy was going through that phase where he wanted to be a more serious actor. So as a result, Axel had to be more mature and not be funny, which is why Beverly Hills Cop 3 is so good.
So,
yes.
It's pretty bad.
It was not a good movie.
Yeah. I remember I did pay money to see that in the movie theaters too. So.
Oh yeah? You really like to go to the movies and be disappointed.
Yes, I do.
I tried my best not to do that. I skipped Beverly Hills Cop 3. I skipped Cobra. I skipped Over the Top. Any final thoughts about Beverly Hills Cop? The script, the first 10 pages, outside of the fact that there's no way a studio would have ever made that movie.
I think you've encapsulated it. Yeah, there's no way. Today or then, yeah.
I've read plenty of early drafts in previous episodes. This is the first screenplay where I read the first 10 pages and said, nope, that 10 pages does not capture or properly set up anything about that Stallone script, except for Stallone himself.
Nope. Right. Yes, it does. Right. Yeah, it sets it up for Stallone. I think that's perfect.
And that's it. Not his character, not his story, not the tone of the movie, not the style of the movie.
No.
And here he is being himself, but with the cool nickname Cobra.
Yes.
That's it.
And the totally and self-conscious man of 30.
Good looking. Isn't he good looking? And enjoys the other men staring at him in the locker room, which I'm not judging. All right. Well, that's it for the first 10 pages. Thank you, Curtis, for joining us. And by us, I mean me.
Thank you for hosting, Keith.
My pleasure. I hope everybody enjoyed this, the first time I've had a guest on the first 10 pages. Hopefully this will see air. See you at the table read.
If you want to continue this conversation and follow me on the socials, I love talking movies, TV, and comic books at The Reality Comics on Blue Sky, which is like Twitter but not, and Instagram. That's both at The Reality Comics. Thank you so much for listening. See you at the table read. The first 10 pages is written, hosted, and edited by Keith Planet. Music by Edison Carter. Any corrections, questions, or comments, please reach out via social media on Blue Sky or Instagram at The Reality Comics. The first 10 pages, copyright 2026.
There's a cobra.